This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So one of the things I try to do every year is to give you an update. Okay, thank you. Can you give you an update of the new drugs and the trials that we're doing at UCSF. First of all, so that you can share the excitement of some of the studies that we're involved with, and at the same time, when a patient shows up with a bottle with a lot of numbers, etc., you know what's the intended purpose of that. And usually, as a background, I always choose something that has some significance. And my wife asked me, what's all these bottled wines? I said, well, we're in the Napa Valley. But I said, no, the significance difference is different, is that you can see the wine cellar pretty full of bottles. And in fact, this is somewhat misleading because the transplant pipeline in terms of immunosuppression is going through a pretty dry period. And we've had very few novel immunosuppressive agents in active clinical trials. On the other hand, at UCSF, we have been very creative, and we've been thinking outside of the box because we know there are lots of unmet needs. And what can we do, in fact, to advance the science and look at different ways of approaching this issue? Because, the issue of the generics and some of the drug companies that used to be more involved in transplantation have basically decreased their activity. And therefore, I think academic centers have to take some lead in trying to break new grounds in transplantation. And I'm going to go over various categories of studies we're doing at UCSF. And just as an example, many years ago, under the category novel drugs, I would have had a number of novel drugs that I would discuss. And here, just take a look. What are the novel drugs? There is a study for DGF. Infusing basically carbon monoxide. There is another study which is very interesting for delayed graft function with a small interferon synthetic RNA agent. Obinutuzumab, I'm going to discuss it in greater detail, is a novel anti-CD20. And the last study that has been already done is a DNA-based CMV vaccine. So, what is missing from this list are the traditional immunosuppressive agents, and hopefully we'll see more interest in the next few years. Now, the other possibility, of course, is to look at the landscape and try to reposition drugs that have bypassed transplant for a number of reasons and see how can they be repositioned on the basis of mechanistic studies and what they do to transplantation. For example, eculizumab, the humanized anti-C5 monoclonal antibodies that you all use for HUS, has an interesting role in potentially preventing DGF, because in ischemia reperfusion injury, the complement which is produced by the kidney plays an important role in the pathogenesis of the injury. And in fact, in experimental animals, if you have an animal that is knocked without mutated so that they don't produce a complement in the kidney, it's very hard to induce ischemia reperfusion injury. And so a study was done. This was a randomized prospective blinded trial where patients at high risk of DGF got either eculizumab or they got placebo. The study is done. We're waiting for the results. So this could be an interesting advance in terms of the whole ischemia reperfusion field. The second study is one that is part of what we call the CTOT. CTOT are the NIH or NIAID's largest supported trials in transplantation, clinical trials in organ transplantation. And usually it's a network of several centers that get together work on a specific protocol or regimen. And this study, the PI is Peter Heger at Mount Sinai, but we're also involved in one of the transplant centers. And the whole concept of the study is that if you block the inflammatory cytokines at the time of ischemia reperfusion, you can do two things. Maybe you can improve the delayed graft function, but more importantly, you block the occurrence, the activation of fibrinogenic genes. And so with infliximab, it's infused anti, it's a chimeric anti-TNF agent. It's infused at the time of transplantation. And so this study is a two-year study to see, in fact, whether we can improve renal function and improve renal histology in those patients who are treated with infliximab. The third study, this is one, it's our own study, an investigator-initiated trial supported by Genentech. So tocilizumab is a humanized anti-IL-6 receptor antibody and blocks the interaction of IL-6 with its receptor and the signaling, downstream inflammatory signaling. And it's approved for use for rheumatoid arthritis. But over the years, there's been very intriguing evidence that it works very nicely in experimental kidney transplantation. Most of the experiments are with heart transplants, and it actually works very well with co-stimulation blockade. But one of the interesting things about the IL-6 pathway is that it has strong modulatory effects, so that if you block the IL-6 pathway, one, you decrease effector cells, but concomitantly, you increase the regulatory cells. So in this study, we're taking patients who at 6 months have intact graft inflammation. So all patients undergo a management biopsy at 6 months. And those patients who have inflammation, they don't have rejection. In other words, they have inflammatory cells and maybe minimal tubulitis, but it doesn't reach the level of having an acute rejection. And these patients, usually, we just monitor them because nobody knows what to do with them. There have been several studies that suggest that if you have inflammation and later on fibrosis, that those grafts will function less well over the next 2-3 years. So anyway, we're taking these patients who have inflammation at 6 months, and we randomize them to either continue standard of care or be infused with tocilizumab monthly for 6 months. And then they get rebiopsied at 6 months later. So we'll see, one, whether we can get rid of the inflammation, whether we can decrease the associated fibrosis. And we have a lot of molecular markers of the kidney, in the urine, and also we're measuring the level of T regulatory cells in the blood to see whether, in fact, we can modulate the immune system towards more regulation. We already have about 15, 16 patients. We hope in about a year to finish the study. Now, the other important initiatives at UCSF are cell therapies. Now, so traditionally, if I were to talk about cell therapies, I would have discussed stem cell, bone marrow infusion, conditioning regimens, primarily with an effort to induce tolerance. Now, these studies are certainly interesting, and mechanistically, they can give us a good understanding of what's happening in the immune system and how to induce tolerance. But I think, there are basically three protocols around the country, three main ones. The one at Stanford with total lymphoid irradiation that has worked in HLA-identical transplant. It's not clear how well it will work in mismatched patients. The group at the MGH have been doing work in this area for several years, and unfortunately, the results have been mixed. And the difficulty and the challenge is that here we're using a recipient of living donor kidneys, and there have been patients who've lost their kidneys or have had very poor function after that. So, I can admire the investigators, but it's a difficult area, really, to sort of investigate because the end point is tolerance, so you have to withdraw drugs, and then you never know for sure what the outcome of that, whether you can induce chimerism or not, and how important in the different protocol is different. Now, the third protocol for cell therapy with stem cells, the one that Northwestern has published extensively, and here they use stem cells, but also they add a so-called facilitator cell that Suzanne Ilstead had discovered. And the facilitator cell has two purposes. One, to improve engraftment. And in fact, In their patients, the majority became chimeric, and some 100% chimeric. And number two, to decrease the risk of graft versus host. Initially, they had none, then they had one, and now they have a second patient. So my concern is that the conditioning regimen and the risk may not necessarily produce an equipoise as we approach these therapies. So at UCSF, we're taking a somewhat more nuanced approach, and that's using Treg cells. And our main objective is not to induce tolerance, but to modulate the immune system toward regulation. It may allow us to maybe minimize immunosuppression ultimately. But in the meantime, we would like to see what is the effect of Tregs as an adjunct agent as part of the immunosuppression. So we're doing two studies in kidney. Sandy Feng is doing several studies in liver. In the kidney, the first study that I want to discuss is the one study, and this is a study Sang Mo Kang is part of. This is primarily a European consortium with a couple of centers in the United States, and it takes patients at the time of transplantation who will get triple therapy, and they are infused with donor antigen reactive T cells, Treg cells. And so this study basically is mostly a safety study because these are living donor kidney recipients. They're going to do very well. It's going to be hard to determine what the Tregs are doing, but at least in this limited trial, we'll know about efficacy. The other study is CTOT-21. This is an NIH-supported study that we initiated. And in this study, what our premise is the following. We know from experimental data that Tregs home to the inflamed tissues. So we're starting with the concept that when we biopsy patients at 6 months, and we're doing the study only in living donor transplant recipients, those patients who have inflammation or borderline rejection, we're going to be treating them with Tregs. So we'll take a unit of blood from the recipient, isolate the Tregs over a period of 2 weeks, expand them so that we get close to 400, 500 million Tregs, and then we reinfuse them in the patients. So one group will be a standard of care, will follow the patients. The second group will receive polyclonal Tregs, meaning we take the Tregs they have in circulation and we expand them. The third group could be the most interesting, and those are that are receive antigen-reactive Tregs. So when we expand the Tregs, we expand them in the presence of donor antigens. And at least experimentally, antigen-reactive Tregs are much more effective than polyclonal Tregs. We can also use Tregs that are infused with deuterium, so they're labeled with deuterium, which is allowed by the FDA, so that when we infuse back these deuterium-labeled Tregs, we can follow what happens to the Tregs in circulation. And on the follow-up biopsy, we can actually determine whether they've gone to the kidney and have had an effect on the inflammation. So this study is about to start, and hopefully we'll give you a follow-up next year. Now, another approach, of course, is to look at our regimens and say, well, how can we improve the regimen and make them more effective and safer? And so belatacept is one of those drugs that we felt required a better approach. And I'll be describing the process of applying a sort of a more modern approach to immunosuppression, one that, of course, oncology has been way ahead of us, and that is applying precision medicine to the use of belatacept as a prototype, but other drugs in the future. And finally, the diagnostics. I think this is starting the era of diagnostics, whereby we get blood and urine, and we look at gene expression profile in these patients, and we can have a non-invasive way to alert us, one, either that there is a rejection or that there is activation of the immune system, and that something should be done to the immunosuppression. So let me go back very quickly to the novel drugs. As I said, in the list, there isn't like your prototype novel immunosuppressive agents. So one study that we have just completed, and some of you may have had patients in it, is in high-risk patients, patients who are CMV negative, who receive a kidney from a CMV positive donor, who are suppressed with, as we usually do, with valganciclovir, we randomize them blindly to either receive a DNA-based vaccine post-transplant or not receive, or receive placebo. And the study has not been unblinded. But one of the reasons behind this, I mean, you would think, you say, well, you know, valganciclovir does a very good job. But in fact, it creates lots of problems. First of all, when you stop the prophylaxis after 3 or 6 months, a great number of patients, depending on the study, 20, 25%, will develop viremia. Half of those may develop actually symptomatic disease. And there are sequelae long-term for CMV viremia. The other problem with valsite is that it produces leukopenia. And this becomes very acute in patients who are highly sensitized, who you see in the clinic 2 weeks after transplant, their white cell count goes down to 1, and you want to stop CellCept, you want to stop valganciclovir, then you consider giving them Neupogen. So it does create potential conflicts in the way you manage patients. So if a DNA vaccine could produce durable cell-mediated immunity, I think it would be a great step forward. The second study, which is still ongoing, and I have it misnomered here, inhaled carbon monoxide. We did a study with inhaled carbon monoxide. This is a study Dr. Fries is doing in DGF, but the carbon monoxide is not inhaled, is delivered with, believe it or not, an infusion of bovine hemoglobin. So why would we give carbon monoxide to patients? Well, carbon monoxide, as you know, it's an inert gaseous agent that has very potent regulatory effect. It has cytoprotective effect. It suppresses inflammatory genes. And at least experimentally in studies in pig transplants, both with warm and cold ischemia, it seems to be very protective. It decreases the rate of rise of the creatinine. It enhances recovery. And gene associated with fibrosis are not as activated. And so this is going to be an interesting study to follow. The next study I'm going to discuss slightly more details. The first one is the use of a novel anti-CD20, obinutuzumab. I have to be careful how I pronounce it. And this is a glyco-engineered so-called type 2 anti-CD20. So now you're all familiar, of course, with rituximab on the right. Obinutuzumab is similar to rituximab. It's a humanized antibody. It binds, in fact, to the same epitope. But as you can see, it binds to the to CD20 and to the same epitope in a differential way. And thus, it has properties that are not shared with rituximab. It's so-called a type 2 anti-CD20 antibody because of the way it binds to the lipid raft. Lipid raft are microdomains in the cell membrane. And rituximab has to bind to multiple of these and cross-link, while obinutuzumab does not need to do that. And the main difference then becomes in the induction of programmed cell death. Obinutuzumab produces that, while rituximab is not as effective. So when we give rituximab, and if you measure the levels of CD19 cell in circulation, you can see with 1,000 milligram, you can easily deplete them. However, the problem is that you don't deplete the lymphoid tissue from B cells. And this is where obinutuzumab may be more effective. And this is the model for cell death by obinutuzumab. And again, much more potent in terms of depletion, not only in circulation, but more importantly in the lymphoid tissue. And so this is the first study. There was a cohort 1 and cohort 2. We put 2 patients in cohort 2. We're approach patients who are very highly sensitized, like 100% PRA. We're giving them 2 doses of obinutuzumab and two doses of IVIG, and then we measure their PRA before and after, and we hope either to get rid of some antibodies or maybe decrease their titer and make them more likely to get transplanted. And of course, in the future, if obinutuzumab proves itself to be more potent than Rituxan, it could take the place of Rituxan in the treatment of antibody-mediated rejection. So the next study is QPI-1002. This is a synthetic small interference RNA agent. So it blocks the expression of P53. As you know, P53 protein is a pro-apoptotic protein, which is expressed in cells that are damaged or ischemic and induces apoptosis. So when QPI is infused in experimental animal, it's a small molecule, it's filtered very quickly, it's taken up by the renal tubule for like 24 hours, and it's very potent suppressor of P53. A phase 2 trial that was done a couple of years ago showed that in recipients who got ECD kidneys, there was a significant decrease in the incidence of delayed graft function by 30%, and there was also a decrease of the number of dialysis that these patients had to undergo. So now the same company started a very large study with QPI-002 to prevent DGF. Again, 634 patients are going to be in the study. They're going to be stratified into two age brackets. There's going to be a selection on the basis of donor criteria so that there is a risk for DGF. And interestingly, it's one dose only at the time of transplantation before reperfusion, and the dose is given very quickly by push over 1 and 2 minutes. And the primary endpoint is, in fact, not DGF rate, but the number of dialysis. Secondary endpoint is the number of dialysis, the duration of, or the number of dialysis required until the patient recovers. Now, this whole field, I think, is in upheaval because of a study that UCSF did, and you will hear about it in the What's New, What's Hot later on today. And the reason for that, Klaus Neumann, one of our anesthesiologists, Ryo Hiroshi, and did a nice study in deceased donors where they reduced the temperature of deceased donors by 2 degrees centigrade, very little. Yet they were able to decrease the DGF rate in recipients who received ECD kidney by the same percentage as the previous study with QPI. So you can imagine a pharmaceutical which is going to market a drug to potentially prevent DGF is not going to be cheap. Yet you can lower the temperature of a donor by 2 degrees for no money whatsoever. The big question, of course, whether these are different mechanisms or separate, are they additive? Can you, in fact, decrease DGF rates by a percentage because you lower the temperature of the donor? And can you, on top of that, if you use another drug, decrease it even further? So I think these studies ultimately will determine which may be the best approach. As I said, novel regimens, we're trying to use belatacept in a more scientific way in order to maximize both its safety and its efficacy. So recently we published the 7-year data on the BENEFIT trial. These are patients who received kidneys from standard criteria or living donor kidneys. And this is the first study that was where the patients were followed all up to 7 years. And as a reminder, in this study, patients received, two arms received belatacept, a more intense regimen, a lower intensity regimen, or cyclosporin as the standard of care. The patients receiving belatacept are CNI-free, so they were on belatacept, MMF, and steroids. All patients get induced with 2 doses of basiliximab. The FDA has approved the use of belatacept in the less intense regimen because it was as effective and safer than the more intense regimen. So at 7 years, these Kaplan-Meier curves show that time to death or graft loss from randomization to month 84 was significantly better in the people in the patients treated with belatacept as compared to cyclosporine. The hazard ratio in both arms at 7 years was 0.57, meaning that there was a 43% reduction in death or graft loss in patients who were treated with belatacept. Furthermore, look at the differences in GFR. So the patients treated with belatacept continued to have high GFR, and over a period of time, the GFR even got better. While, as you would expect with CNI, the GFR tended to be a tiny bit lower over time. And you can see in the benefit LI arms that the difference between the two arms started, at 13.5 ml the first year, and at 7 years, it was 27 ml per minute. So the lack of nephrotoxicity and vasoconstriction does seem to be paying a dividend longer term. And another interesting feature of the study was that patients treated with belatacept did not develop or very rarely developed donor-specific antibodies. Now, the patient with cyclosporine, about 20% developed antibodies. This was highly statistically significant. If you look at any cross-sectional studies of patients treated with CNI, on average, 20 to 25% of patients over several years will develop donor-specific antibodies. Those who develop donor-specific antibodies have a higher rate of AMR and higher rate of graft loss. So this is, I believe it's going to be an important effect of this therapy. However, patients treated with belatacept had higher incidence of cellular rejection at the beginning. And one of the troublesome things about it is that some of these rejections were histologically more severe. And so this has been a potential issue and problem with this therapy, because although long-term graft survival is better and GFR is better, I think transplant physicians don't like to see higher rejection rate early after transplantation. Now, in terms of the antibody-mediated rejection, which is really a potential great area for belatacept, these are studies that have been done by Anita Chung at the University of Chicago, showing the central role of co-stimulation in terms of activation B cell to the germinal center, which then get transformed into antibody secreting cell, both in the primary response and in the recall response. So in the experimental studies, not only can you block donor-specific antibodies and AMR, but if you take experimental animals with a transplant that have started an AMR and have developed ESA, if you treat them with CTLA-4Ig, which is basically the first-generation belatacept, you can actually abort the progression of AMR. So I think this is going to be an interesting potential use of belatacept. So if belatacept, improves outcome, graft survival, patient survival, GFR, DSA. We've shown in the first year, because it's not a CNI, doesn't have the cardiovascular risk factors, doesn't produce as much diabetes or hypertension. Why hasn't it been embraced in a greater fashion by the transplant community? One, as I said, the higher rejection rate. And so it requires better regimen. Second thing is the PTLD. There were more PTLD in the studies. They were predominantly present in patients who are EBV negative. And so nowadays, EBV negative patients cannot receive belatacept. They have to be EBV positive. And I think if you reduce the rejection rate, the PTLD data is going to be pretty similar to what we get with conventional therapy. Now, the IV administration, when this drug was initially marketed, it looked like it was a negative. But nowadays, when we look at all the data about why people lose kidneys long-term, and there have been several studies, one of them by the group of Phil Halloran. So if you take patients who had good function and later on lose kidney function, and you do detailed analysis of the causes of late graft loss, 65%, close to 65% of patients lose the graft because of chronic antibody-mediated rejection. Half of those, it's because they have been non-adherent. Now, when we discuss non-adherence, it's not a patient who goes one day to the other and stops all the immunosuppression. It means taking the drugs erratically, taking them different times, skipping Saturday night, evening, and so on. And so the IV administration actually gives you an assurance of adherence. And so I look at it more as a positive than a negative. And of course, the cost is an issue because now we have generic immunosuppression, less costly. Belatacept is more expensive. Of course, you know, in all cost-benefit analysis, if you take in account graft loss, patient loss, cardiovascular disease, et cetera, the cost differential may be much different. But I think one of the issues we are tackling with the cost is how to maybe administer belatacept in a way to reduce cost. And so the first thing we've done is to change the induction. Instead of using an anti-IL-2, now we started to use low-dose thymoglobulin, 3 milligram per kilo. The reason for that is IL-2. I mean, when IL-2 were developed, and they're really nice, safe drugs, but not very potent, we had no idea that T-reg cells have CD25 on the cell surface, and that when you use anti-IL-2, you also deplete T-regs. On the other hand, thymoglobulin, while it depletes all T-cells, it has partial sparing effect on T-regs. And so you proportionally end up with more T-regs. The other change that we have instituted is that there's been a fair amount of experimental evidence that, in fact, the better anti-proliferative with co-stimulation blockade is not MMF, mycophenolate mofetil, but actually the mTOR inhibitors. And so with that in mind, we have changed our protocol since belatacept got approved. We use 3 milligram per kilo of thymoglobulin, belatacept, lower intensity regimen, low dose steroids. We use MPA for 4 weeks. The patient can heal completely. And then at 4 weeks, we get the urine protein, we make sure the patient has healed, and then we convert them to everolimus, and we follow them since after that. And so with this protocol, we have treated 33 patients. Of those 33 patients, 11, after were converted to everolimus, did not tolerate it for a number of reasons and were placed back on MMF. The overall rejection rate in these patients was 9%, and it so happened that all the rejection occurred in the patients that were on MMF, none in the everolimus group. So we are you know, certainly encouraged by this protocol, but we wanted to go a bit further. Okay, the protocol is good, and we're applying to everyone, but is everyone a good candidate for belatacept? And can we be more selective? In fact, can we apply precision medicine to transplantation? And so Alan Kirk has done nice studies showing that patients on belatacept who have a rejection have in circulation a higher percentage of CD4 cells called CD57. Now, what are CD57? These are CD57 cells are terminally differentiated memory cells. They used to consider them senescent cells, but in fact, they can get activated. And one of the properties of these memory cells is that they do not respond to belatacept. They are actually resistant to co-stimulation blockade. And the left figure shows that at least in Alan Kirk's studies, that patients who had rejection on belatacept had higher levels of CD57 cell as compared to those who were stable. Now, actually, it's not only CD57 cells. It's CD57 cells that are PD-1 negative. Now, PD-1, of course, is an inhibitory receptor, and therefore, if these cells get activated, they have no check on their activation. We actually like to call them uncle cells, because they are unconstrained effectors. You activate them and they remain activated. And so Dr. Zoltan, Lasek, our pathologist, looked at a bunch of biopsies of patients who rejected on CNI and belatacept. And so the red are the C4D cells, and the brown are the CD57. The top figure is a patient, is a prototype of a patient who was on belatacept, had rejection. And you can see there is a lot of red and brown in the interstitium, and these are the CD4 cells. On the bottom figure is a patient with acute cellular rejection who was treated with CNI, and you can see predominantly CD4 cells. You don't see any CD57. So this data is suggestive that these cells potentially could be troublesome. And so what we have decided is to take patients at the time when we want to put them on belatacept, get the peripheral blood, run them through flow, and then look at the, analyze their CD57 PD-1 negative cells. These are gated in TEMRA. This is the T effector memory cells. And if the patient has a high number of these cells, maybe they should not be on belatacept. And if they have low numbers, we treat them with belatacept. So it happened a couple of years ago. We ran 105 patients with flow just to see what we found in terms of memory cells, TEMRA cells. And about 38 of these 105 were TEMRA positive. And then we found out that, in fact, about most of these TEMRA positive were CD57 positive, and maybe half of them were PD-1 negative. I just want to give you an example of what we're doing. So these are three patients that came in for belatacept regimen. The one to the left, you can see the PD-1, CD57, the left upper quadrant. This patient has very few CD57 positive, PD-1 negative. And so this patient is a good candidate. The middle one has about 8% cells in that quadrant, the CD57 positive, PD-1 negative. This is a borderline case. And the last one to the right had very high levels, basically close to 30% of the TEMRA cells were CD57 and PD-1 negative. And these, this is the type of patients may not do well on belatacept. So again, precision medicine, we'll see how well it works. And then we want to apply it to another group of patients, and this is called the PROBE study, which is about to start. And as I said earlier, one of the issues we have is, can we decrease the cost of belatacept? And what we're trying to do here is take patients several years out who are on belatacept doing well on MMF and prednisone, and using the novel molecular diagnostic for activation of T cells and B cells, and urine that shows whether there is an increase in inflammatory molecules. So we start the patients. We get a baseline for these tests. If all the tests tell us that the patient has a quiescent immune system, we withdraw prednisone first, and then we repeat the test. If they remain quiescent, we withdraw MMF. And then they're going to be on monotherapy, which by itself I think is going to be fantastic for the patient. But then what we want to do in these patients is convert them to every 8-week belatacept. And so we've had from the phase 2 trial, the first 2 trial, a group of patients that were randomized to every 8-week belatacept that have done quite well. And so the question here, can we select out on the basis of these molecular markers those patients that could benefit from, and both in terms of safety and efficacy, from being on less frequent belatacept infusions? So my vision here is that you have a patient who's 3 years out, who you withdraw steroids, you withdraw MMF, and then they're on monotherapy belatacept, which is great. But then you convert them to every 8 weeks. So what do they end up in terms of their immunosuppression? 6 times a year, they go in for an infusion of belatacept. So if this is not an improvement in the quality of life, I don't know what is. And they don't have to worry about nephrotoxicity, hyperlipidemia, hypertension that is driven by the immunosuppressive agents. I'm running late, so I'm just going to say that we are increasingly utilizing a test called KSORT, Kidney Solid Organ Response Test, which was developed by Minnie Sarwell, and she has published extensively on this test. KSORT is a PCR test assessing the gene expression profile of RNA isolated from the whole blood. So the concept here is two things. One, potentially, and at least in the study, it showed that it had very high correlation with rejection or no rejection. So you may be able to get the blood test and not do a biopsy. But I think more importantly, that if you are doing maneuvers like reducing steroids, withdrawing steroids, withdrawing some immunosuppressive agent, you can get an early call that there is immune activation before you actually get a rising creatinine injury. And so this is a PCR that measures 17, the expression of 17 genes, and the expression of these 17 genes is put in an algorithm, and then you get a score. If the patient has a score of 0.5 to 1.5, it is consistent with rejection. Minus 0.5 to 0.5 is intermediate. You need to repeat the test. It can go either way. And if the patient has a score below 0.5, then it would indicate a quiescent state. And both the positive predictive value and the negative predictive values are in the low 90%, so it could become very useful. So this is an example of what could happen. This is a patient, pre-acute rejection, who was followed with KSORT, and the KSORT, as you can see, at 8 months and before at 8 months was below 50% or below 0.5, so it's quiescent. 4 months before an episode of acute rejection, when the creatinine was still stable, a KSORT sent a red signal that now it's positive. And in fact, a few weeks later, the patient had a clinical rejection. So the rejection was treated, and after treatment, the KSORT came back down to a quiescent level. So we're doing a study now called the PRISM study, where we take 75 patients who are highly immunized. They have a very high PRA, therefore at higher risk of rejection. And we're following them with every 2 weeks KSORT. And we're going to be in a prospective, not in a cross-sectional manner, but in a prospective everyday standard of care follow-up, see what is the correlation between, you know, KSORT and rejection, and how can it be useful in not only indicating that there is a rejection. I think what we like it even more if it indicates to us that there is immune activation and that the rejection may be around the corner unless you can do something about altering the immunosuppression. So there is more work ahead for us. So in conclusion, regulation, endpoint, cost, and genetics have stifled innovation in transplantation, and I think it's really up to the academic centers to come up with ideas and engage drug companies and the scientists at drug companies to either bring novel molecules or maybe reposition ones and so on. And the second thing is that the unmet needs still persist and require novel approaches and novel solutions. I'd like to thank you for your attention and be happy to answer any question.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.